the appearances of this world are sometimes miraculous. But what is not this world is even more miraculous. Somehow on the way in, I caught this string of what looked like tiny jewels hanging off my robe, and I thought, I'll offer them to the Buddha. So when I got up to the altar, I picked this like shimmering stream of jewels. I didn't know what it was really, but it looked like a beautiful offering, and I laid it down on the table, and as I was offering incense, I looked closer, and it was moving, living beings. Hundreds of tiny spiders, tiny, tiny, all strung on this like 3 foot long string. So appearances in this world can be startling and seemingly miraculous. And we can interpret them as trying to tell us something. All these appearances of the world are giving us messages all the time. Like, were these sentient beings yearning for many lifetimes to meet with the unsurpassed, penetrating, perfect Dharma, rarely met with in hundreds of thousands of eons? And then they thought, today we have a chance. Catch the edge of that robe. Take us to the Zendo where we might hear the Buddha's words. And they made it very close. And if there was a way to keep them on the altar, that would have been nice, but I feared that they would then make their way to the floor and get crushed under our feet.
And so a great wind arose, and they found themselves flying through the air and landing in a green sea of something.
A green sea of Dharma. Different than the one they expected. You know, the workings of this world make me wonder, if it's the way we think it is. I kind of think not. Last night I was remembering, I was considering, you know, speaking during Zazen, sometimes happens, and I was recalling ancient years ago at Tassajara, when my teacher would sometimes spontaneously speak during Zazen. And I was remembering one time when the strange words came out in the Zendo. On the shoreline, on the beach of countless worlds, the children play. And he said that, and then there was this piercing yell from like the other end of the valley. Ah! Sent a shiver up the spine. Everyone was supposed to be in the Zendo. It was Sesshin who yelled in Tassajara winter. And right at the time that I recall that story that I haven't thought of in a long time, right at that moment, outside our Zendo, there was this yell.
Four-letter word.
Yes. And that sent a shiver up my spine. Like, I'm not going to say anything. I don't understand how this world works. I really don't. It's a relief that all of this is only this one mind. Huangbo, our ancestor, I refrained from reading this section last night because this is a kind of dangerous section. So, you know, you might not want to tell this to all your friends. It's just, you know, let's just keep this kind of quiet. We'll post it on the internet later. As to performing the six paramitas, you know, these great bodhisattva practices like giving and precepts, patience, diligence, concentration, wisdom, and the vast numbers of similar practices, or gaining merits as countless as the sands of the Ganges. Since you are fundamentally complete in every respect, being this one mind that is all Buddhas and all sentient beings, you should not try to supplement that perfection by such meaningless practices. So Huangbo, you know, he had this one mind and this one agenda, and he just kept trying to drive his point home, even going so far as to say these great Dharma practices like the six paramitas, you don't need to do anything, really, because you're fundamentally complete. This one mind. But he's not necessarily criticizing, like, don't ever do them. He's just saying, since you're fundamentally complete in every respect, you should not try to supplement that perfection by such meaningless practices. When there is occasion for them, perform them. And when the occasion is past, remain quiescent. So just, you know, practice giving when the conditions in the apparent world are appropriate for that. And when they've passed, this is maybe especially a Sesshin instruction too, right? Like, if you're a meal server and it's time to practice offering the meal, then the conditions are there for that and you offer the meal. And then when you go back to Zazen, you don't think, I wish I could be offering another meal now, practicing some giving. I should get up and do that, but actually, when the conditions aren't there, just remain quiescent. And then he says, if you are not absolutely convinced that mind is Buddha, and if you're attached to forms, practices, and meritorious performances, your way of thinking is false and quite incompatible with the way. Doesn't mean that we don't do any practices or forms, but if we're attached to them as the cause for improving this Buddha mind, that's kind of off track. And I thought that was a strong way of speaking, to say, if you're not absolutely convinced that mind is Buddha, and then you're doing these practices to try to, like, do something else, then that's not in accord with the way. Mind is Buddha, nor are there any other Buddhas or any other mind. It's bright and spotless as emptiness, having no form or appearance whatever. To make use of your minds to think conceptually is to leave the essence and attach yourselves to form or characteristics. The ever-existent Buddha is not a Buddha of characteristics or attachment. To practice the six paramitas and myriad similar practices with the intention of becoming a Buddha, thereby, is to advance by stages, to gradually become a Buddha. But the ever-existent Buddha is not a Buddha of stages, only awake to the one mind, and there's nothing whatsoever to be attained. This is the real Buddha. The Buddha and all sentient beings are one mind and nothing else. So, practices to try to create a better Buddha mind or a better sentient being are off track. We might doubt this. So then there's this other point of being absolutely convinced that this very mind is Buddha. And how does that happen? We don't know. In this sesshin, we can be open to the Buddhas convincing us. Not some Buddhas outside, right? But the Buddha, this one mind that is all Buddhas and all sentient beings. Let it convince us. Yes. Yeah, well, I think the convinced he's talking about is not a conceptual convinced. It's like trust beyond doubt. Yeah, that's not it, right? Yeah. Like, if we just agree, like, okay, let's vote on whether this mind is Buddha or not, and like, who agrees and who doesn't agree. I don't think it's that kind of thing. Like, okay, or it's not even that either. Like, the okay, I'm convinced. You convinced me. Yeah, it's not me that's convinced. Right? So he says, if you are not absolutely convinced, but I don't think he's talking to merely the sentient being that feels to be apart from the one mind and the Buddha, talking to the one mind. Is the one mind convinced that it's one mind? Yes.
Preceptor at the time, who was one of the preceptors, Leslie, allowed me to talk about how my practice seemed to produce behaviors in me which looked like the preceptor. And I slowly, it was convincing. It was convincing that doing practice makes the precepts follow. And then I went over to Tenshin Roshi, and repeated the whole process. And I insisted again that it seems to me that there are good standards, and that when I am somehow violating, behavior comes up that doesn't look like the precepts. The problem is my practice, not my behavior. I am slacking in my practice. And that's the signal. So, and I think that's why he gave me my second name, Kaige, which means precept flower. And so when I hear this, I'm thinking, yes, I think that's what we're talking about there. Practice was persuasive that I change my behavior quite naturally in a way that looks like a precept. And my behavior will tell me if I'm slacking out of practice. So I'm convinced. I'm convinced.
In other words, not trying to practice the precepts to make a better Johnny or even a better world.
No, or even to be seen as one who is practicing the precepts.
Mm-hmm. But that they arise from practice mind, yeah, as the occasion calls them forth.
Yeah, and that also extends to practices and rituals. My involvement in them arises spontaneously, not because I've studied how somebody and how they do it. If I'm in a place where people are moving the same way, the choreography kind of speaks for itself. I just go along with it to the extent that I'm physically able, without a concern of, am I doing it right? Will I be able to qualify for Rockefeller Center? Can I be a Zen Rockette? Doesn't matter. But for me, I find myself able to better calibrate my stability and balance as I'm doing the forms, because they're kind of fixed. And I get to see how I'm well balanced, even if I'm not doing it very well, according to anybody else. So I am convinced that this practice and these rituals and all these kinds of things provide a kind of flower in your garden that gives very good indication as to whether there is a Buddha.
So we have, in Zazen especially, we have lots of practices and forms that we just, we go along with. I think that is the spirit in Zazen, is just, here's what we decided on. And some things we kind of change as we go along, possibly, but now it's in motion, let's just do it. So I don't know how people feel about, like, we have these, we're experimenting with these very long morning services with lots of names. And so that's part of the thing is, and they're in other languages. So, and they're transliterated with the most awkward transliteration systems known to the human world, like pinyin. Chinese pinyin transliteration, where they use Q's to transliterate CH, and they use X's to transliterate SH. Why on earth would someone have come up with such a system? And then why are we using it? But here it is. And so can we actually just go along with and wholeheartedly invoke these strange sounding names. And it might be that the nature of each of those names is this one mind, right? That's what actually the names are celebrating, the embodiment. All these myriad men and women embodying one mind. So we could just say, we dedicate this merit to the one mind that's all Buddhas and all sentient beings. Now we have dedicated our practice to all those great teachers. and it will be a very short service. But instead, we list the names of the embodiments of all of manifesting this one mind, just to see like how our one mind deals with it. Can we actually go along with that? So you're welcome in the, you know, after Sesshin. Wait for another few days. After Sesshin, you can offer me your feedback on whether it's too many names to chant. So speaking of names and not being able to be convinced with, you know, words and names, we have the we have the Lankavatara Sutra. Section 32. Mahamati once more asked the Buddha, Bhagavan, please explain for us the essential characteristics of word projection. We've heard a lot about projections. Now we're going to explore words, how words and language tie in here. Bhagavan, once I and the other bodhisattvas understand the essential characteristics of such word projection and are able to penetrate the two kinds of truth regarding words and what they express, so that's the two kinds of truth he's referring to is words and what they express, then we will quickly attain unsurpassed perfect enlightenment, and we will use these two kinds of truth regarding words and what they express to free all beings from impurity. So please help us bodhisattvas understand about words, projections, and what they are and what they express, so that then we can free beings with words. So please tell us. And actually, if you wouldn't mind, tell us in words. Because if you're just silent and you just send that multicolored beam of light out of your forehead, that will help clarify some things, but not everything. So please use language of our, you know, current Indian culture and instruct us. The Buddha replied, Mahamati, listen carefully and ponder this well, and I will tell you with words. Mahamati said, wonderful Bhagavan, may we be so instructed. Buddha told Mahamati, there are four kinds of word projection. Object words, dream words, words for attachment to mistaken projections, and words for projections without beginning. So now who's going to define these? First is object words. Object words arise from attachment to the projection of forms and characteristics. And Red Pine's note, which I assume he's picking up from commentaries on the sutra, he associates these four types of word projection with these different types of consciousness that now we know about. There's the five sense consciousnesses. There's the six mental consciousness that overlays, you could say, the five sense consciousnesses and conceptualizes them. Then there's the seventh consciousness that further uses the sixth consciousness to project a self and object duality onto things. And then there's the eighth consciousness that is receiving all of that activity of the other seven consciousnesses and giving rise to the seven consciousnesses. Right, that's the summary of the Yogacara eight consciousnesses. So these object words, according to this note, are associated with sense, the five sense consciousnesses. So again, the sutra says, object words arise from attachment to the projection of forms and characteristics. So I would understand that to mean object words are like blue. It's like the word that, a word or concept that just goes with the sensory experience of an object, of a sense object. That's why it's called an object word. Blue, or cough sound, or incense smell, or soup taste, or butt pain. Five senses. So those are object words arising from attachment to the projection of forms and characteristics, like colors and sounds are characteristics of objects. So and they're projections according to mind only, right? Even these basic objects of colors and sounds, tastes and so on, are projections. And they have words that go with them, and object words arise from attachment to the projection of forms and characteristics. So that's one kind of words. Dream words arise from recollecting previously experienced realms that upon waking are found to be non-existent. And the note correlates this with the sixth consciousness, mental consciousness. So we could say one story might be, here we have a object word of black color, and then the conceptual mental consciousness of black color as a book. It's more than just the pure sense perception. There's also a conceptual object that's black here called a book. Let's say. So the dream word of book arises from recollecting previously experienced realms. In other words, because we've seen books before, we know that this is a book. Books look like these rectangular things with pages. They're sometimes black, sometimes other colors, but they have a color and a form. And because we've experienced them before, we have a kind of disposition towards the concept of a book. And therefore, we have a word that goes with that concept book. So again, dream words like book, zendo, altar, person, spider, arise from recollecting previously experienced realms that upon awaking are found to be non-existent. So you could say, it's actually, this is really just a dream, that this is a book. Upon awaking to the truth of all things are just mind, nothing whatsoever outside of mind, then the dream of the book disappears in that awakening, and the realm of books is found to be non-existent. So the sentence here again. Dream words, for conceptual things, arise from recollecting previously experienced realms that upon awaking are found to be non-existent, you know, as an external book apart from mind. So, third type of words. Words for attachment to mistaken projections arise from recollecting previous acts of hostility And the note says, this is associated with the seventh consciousness, that's, as you recall, manas, that's associated with self-view and self-confusion, self-pride, self-attachment. So now we're calling this words for attachment to mistaken projections. Is the name of this kind of word. And that's what the seventh consciousness does. It not only projects, but you could say it strongly attaches or grasps the mistaken projections as like my book, you could say. Not only is it just the color black and direct sensory perception, not only is it a conceptual object of a book, but now it's the seventh consciousness, that's like the sense of me and this object, it is like my book. Or, you know, your book would be another projection of the seventh consciousness. But it's all, everything's in relation to me now. You know, so your stuff is also in relation to me because it's not my stuff. So it's, you know, you could imagine maybe just the concept of a book with no sense of like self, personal self around it. It's just a book. And the seventh is particularly adding in this thing of like me and stuff in relation to me. So again, this is called words for attachment to mistaken projections which arise from recollecting previous acts of hostility. And maybe Red Pine's note is helpful here. He says, some commentators think hostility here is short for hostility and kindness. Like, you know, any relationship that the self might have to things. But this is not supported by any of the Sanskrit or Chinese translations. None of them include kindness, even though some commentaries do. And Red Pine says, however, the place of hostility here is clearer when it's understood that it's based on the seventh consciousness or ego consciousness. Because wherever the ego is involved, hostility and not kindness is the operant emotion. So that's kind of a strong statement. But I think he's saying, you know, because the ego, the self, can be kind too. But I think it's implying this problematic realm of disturbance that arises with the seventh consciousness, which can, you know, it can be contrived as a self being, I think I'll be kind now, but maybe we could even say true kindness, true loving kindness of Buddha doesn't arise from the seventh consciousness, but from the one mind. It's again, it's a kind of funny thing. There's a lot of funny things in the sutra.
Usually when people have a kind experience, like falling in love, there's a great proclamation, it's all just one thing. You know? So, however, when there's a falling out of love, or there is the sense that I'm being disrespected, there's always hostility. There.
Yeah.
So hostility maybe stands for individuating myself from others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think maybe hostility, or I guess one other Chinese version, it's translated more as like enmity. Yeah, a sense of separation. Hostility is a strong word, maybe a little too strong for this sense, if I was choosing the word. There. Words for attachment to mistaken projections arise from recollecting previous acts of hostility. We could say from recollecting previous self-other relationships, which are don't always result in something as strong as hostility, but some, again, this is the realm I'm kind of pointing towards when I'm saying that word, discomfort, what was the word? Saying we can look for disturbance. disturbance, self and other relationships, are characterized by a certain amount of very subtle or very large disturbance. And when disturbance due to others is very large, we could call it hostility. But something about this self that's associated with the seven consciousness creates so-called words for attachment to mistaken projections. And the fourth, final type of words is words for projections without beginning. Endless streams of words for projections, beginningless projections and endless projections. And they arise from the habit energy of the seeds. Remember, these are these Yogacara terms. The permeation of karmic seeds, of past attachments to beginningless projections. And this is associated with the storehouse consciousness, the eighth, or alaya vijnana. So again, words for projections without beginning arise from the habit energy of the seeds of past attachments to beginningless projections. So that's kind of another way of saying they arise from alaya, straight up, you know, with no need for colors and sounds. The seeds can just sprout from alaya during zazen without looking at anything. Words and concepts can just arise from the storehouse. This is what characterizes the four kinds of word projection.
So what's a word from the book, on the fourth one?
On the book, yes. Yeah. Let's see. So reviewing again, first it's the color black is the object projection is called. The concept of the book is, does anybody remember the second one? What it's called, but what that kind of word is called? Dream words. Dream words, dream book, concept of book. Color black is the object word. The book is the dream word. The my book is the words for attachment to mistaken projections. And the last one, words for projections without beginning, are, we could say, the fact that we could think of the book without even seeing the book. How about that? Like, we're just sitting in zazen and we have a clear image of the book and all our associations with it. My book. Where did I leave my book, actually? I wonder if somebody else took my book. Or all these things that could arise without even seeing it at all. Just directly from the storehouse consciousness. And you could say it arises from these past permeations and seeds planted in alaya. So right now, when the first three types of words, black, book, my book, my black book, that experience right now of my black book, it just planted a seed in the storehouse. And that seed of this direct experience of my black book now can give rise to another imagination of my black book without the direct experience, because now it's in alaya. Yes.
So sometimes I hear coming my way, mm-hmm. Right, I do this, where, say, there's something, and the response is, you always or you never. Could that be like before?
You mean you're thinking that? Or somebody's saying
that? Somebody's saying that. Or even if I did it, maybe it makes a difference. If I were to say to somebody, based upon some small incident that just happened, always or you never, wouldn't that be kind of coming out of past habit energy?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if that could also be the third.
Yeah.
You know, you're this person in relation to me that always does that which bothers me. I wouldn't even say you always do that if I didn't have some personal thing about it in the first place. So it's maybe a and in fact, I think all these maybe aren't totally distinct. They're all words are flying around all the time and affecting these different types of words. Four different types could be affecting each other. And in a way, maybe the fourth type is affecting all the other three all the time. Because in fact, we also have the story that we don't even see the color black except because of our past seeds for seeing black in Alaya, right? So, so I'd say, yeah, you always do that, Johnny. Why do you always do that to me? Then you could say that's like the seventh type, but affected by all the past times that I think that you did that, which of course you've never done before, because we never can do anything more than once. In fact, or to say you always do that is kind of like, I think that there's that you're repeating yourself, or that you're the same Johnny that you were a moment ago, but actually you're a completely fresh, sprouted seed of Johnny-ness out of Alaya, based on, like, you know, my storehouse has approximately 3,782 Johnny seeds. They're over in the back left, and and they have all different flavors and stuff. So, you know, if enough of them have the same flavor, then I might say, like, you always do that, because look at how many seeds. But each one is a particular individual seed, and the one that is sprouting right now is distinct from all those other seeds. The Johnny that's sprouting from my mind, because actually you're not really over there. Well, yes. Sure, yes.
I want to get back to the Wang Bo a little bit.
The what?
Wang Bo.
Oh, yeah, it's Wang Bo.
I'm totally convinced that I'm very nice to do that. And, you know, we've looked at those koans before. You know, this mind is good.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I think so with my fourth type of words and concepts from Alaya. As a Yogacara lover, I think, of course, Wang Bo is talking about Yogacara. But in fact, they very rarely, you know, occasionally they, like those first five ancestors did seem to quote the Lankavatara Sutra somewhat regularly. Wang Bo, I don't think ever does quote it directly or mention the Yogacara school. He does mention some sutras. But I think it's informed by, you know, especially, yeah, I definitely think it's informed. I think if the Yogacara school and the teachings of the Lankavatara Sutra and Asanga and Vasubandhu never appeared in the world, if there wasn't that condition in the world, I would be surprised if Wang Bo would have been able to say, you know, all Buddhas and all sentient beings are only this one mind, outside of which nothing exists. You know, that there's nothing outside. That's your Dharma name, right?
Yeah.
No outer limits. Yeah, or limitless.
But I guess the point I'm trying to make is, you know, when we look at those sutras or those poems, it kind of, we would come around to sort of saying, to say, if we look right here into this being and this in our thoughts, that's where we can find liberation. And that's kind of one interpretation of this very mind. It's very close to home, this liberation. You find liberation where you fall down. You know,
liberation.
You have to get up from the very place that you fall down. You have to look at this very mind, this very moment.
It can't be outside your immediate experience.
But this kind of hearkens, it's cosmic. And the yoga chara school is supposedly this reaction to the know-nothing,
I wouldn't call it cosmic, actually, though. It sounds that way. And we can hear it as this one mind in that cosmic way. But I hear it as just very kind of down to earth, actually. That you could say this one experience right now, it includes, you know, when we say all Buddhas and all sentient beings, you could say, well, those are our, you know, if there's more than one Buddha and sentient being, that's just our idea. All the Buddhas and sentient beings that if we could experience all Buddhas and all sentient beings, we would experience them in this one mind. So I don't think it's saying, it could be interpreted as there's this one cosmic mind that's connecting us all. I don't actually hear it that way, although it's very easy to hear it that way.
Which is another way I think of interconnectedness and the topic of Garba and this Alaya.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we could call this Alaya dash Tathagata Garba of the sutra. We could call that total dynamic functioning, and then but without the mind only Yogacara slant on it, we think it's total dynamic functioning of the universe out there, of which we're a little part. So we're just saying it's the same universe, but this universe. The dynamic functioning of the universe is not out there. And it's not in here either. But it's a personal experience. Personal or just a very close experience of the total dynamic working of the universe. Like you said at the beginning, it kind of brings it back home. It makes it... there's something very kind of warm and intimate about this one mind, instead of saying the total dynamic working of like the African ocean over there is part of dynamic working, but you know, I don't feel so intimate with that really. But if we say that the African ocean is an aspect of this one mind and its dynamic working, something, it brings it back closer to like this immediate experience right here and now, not abstract somewhere else. And of course, you know, as we use all these words, particularly these are dream words, six consciousness dream words. We're talking about something inconceivable that words don't reach. So the problem with this one mind thing is it can either, the two extremes it can fall into, it seems like, are either it's this one giant cosmic mind that becomes this metaphysical abstraction, or it becomes this very narrow, personal, solipsistic self-mind that, like, the African Ocean is me, or something. Those are the two extremes. Either contracted into this very narrow, non-liberating, because it's too caught up in just my limited self, or this vast cosmic thing that's also not so liberating because it's a nice abstract idea, but it's not actually, it's outside my experience somehow, it's too abstract. So in between those two extremes, this one mind is all there is, and it's inconceivable in terms of location, and as it said at the very beginning, it's not small, like my little one mind, and it's not big, like the whole universe, the cosmos. It's not about size. So, and then our mind starts to, we try to get a hold of what it is in between those two extremes, and our mind just starts to dissolve because we can't. Because our conceptual dream mind can't actually pin it down. Yet, these dream words are helpful. Mahamati said, you know, it seems like maybe mainly what the sutras are, of these four types of words, the sutras are maybe using mostly the second type of dream words that are like just conceptual constructions. So Mahamati's like, give us some dream words, Buddha. And the Buddha's like, I will. Here they are. There'll be a lot more to come too. And may they be helpful. May the dream words help to liberate from the dream. But I definitely see this, this emphasis on mind and mind outside of which nothing else exists is almost like straight up Yogacara. It just throws some little creative Zen sprinkles on that ice cream cone of mind. So I'll spare you the reflections on reality till a future talk. Maybe just before we close, not too big a thing, but this practice of noticing disturbances and then seeing if we notice at the time of disturbance that there's a kind of like externality involved. How's that? Are people trying that out some, or even right now? Like, how might that be going? I wonder. Does it seem like a straightforward experiment?
Yes. This morning, while we were here contemplating the Blue Mountains, somebody put a note on my car saying, if you're homeless, go to shelter. That's this. And so, my first thought was, bitch.
Hostility. Seventh type of word. Third type of word associated with the second consciousness, yeah.
And so then I thought of what I said last night, or yesterday. This, this, the
project exceptions to unity. And as soon as I thought of that, the disturbance went away. And I started realizing this lady is probably the mother of a child over here and very worried about this object and all kinds of stuff. Well, it's still up here with thick.
Lady or gent?
Most clearly, well, I mean, it was a very florid gent.
Oh.
I think they are having, that's what it is. Fine. But
there are such gents.
I don't think they'd be bothering you like that. But it was interesting to see just how instantaneously arose this defensiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And it took a practice to get into something else so I could deal with my opinion of my critical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a good one. And then seeing like, I think particularly in this mind only and study of the apparently external world and what is it, to know like, I'm kind of suggesting that we try to, in addition to those practices, catch like, oh. Is this basic fundamental thing, almost underlying all the stories about who did this and why they did it and stuff, that this note came from outside my mind. You know, it's external to mine. And I'm saying, making that connection, that you could say it's disturbing for various reasons, because, like, you know, I'm just trying to do sashin and da 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 da. But this basic underlying thing of, like, the note is not me, or not this mind, I guess we should say, accurately. And like I did it last night too, when the scream, or yell outside the Zendo game, I tried to do that right away of like, oh, is it? It's a little disturbed, it has a kind of hostile vibration to this four-letter word wafting into the peaceful Zendo. And then I noticed, like, do I think that there's a person out there apart from my mind, and that word is out there apart from my mind, and just exploring that relationship. And I had this special advantage of, like, having just thought of this time in the past at Tassajara when there was this yell at that time. So it wasn't even that hard for me to make the leap of, like, ooh, did actually my mind really just create that? It was almost like that didn't seem so far off in that case because of this uncanny coincidental nature of it. But, we were talking about some, like, serving issues yesterday. And I could feel, like, energy rising in the this conversation was getting very energetic. I wouldn't say hostile, but there was some, like, it was an energetic conversation in a peaceful session, which is nice. It's kind of like, let's wake up. but I thought, like, I couldn't really catch it right in the moment, but afterwards there was some, like, energetically there was, again, I'm using this word disturbances, not necessarily extremely disturbing, but just like, I don't feel completely relaxed. And I thought, okay, there. Do I think that the people in the conversation and the conversation itself and serving in the Zendo is all something happening outside my mind? I'm like, yes, I most definitely do. I don't think it's my mind. And that's why I'm not quite as relaxed. But can I, like, see, like, it's my movie. Can I stay in my... This is my movie about issues of how we're going to, like, serve meals in the Zendo and stuff.
But what about when it really is outside your mind?
Oh! You don't have the complete conviction!
Oh, okay. So this morning, okay. I'm not feeling great, right? So I'm sitting here this morning.
You can hear the roughness in the throat.
I was wondering what this blank send up is called.
Oh, yeah.
And that blank either.
Yeah.
Once again.
Yes.
It's not working. And not only that, I used to sit over there. I happen to be sitting right here. So, then, I heard it come on, which is usually, like, the most exciting sound in the universe.
During Zazen?
Yeah, it just magically comes on after it decides it's not going to come on. But then, I'm sitting here, and I'm feeling this cold. room and touch the air. Is it cold or is it hot?
Because there's a few heaters in there, and you can have a vent.
And probably there's some cold air in the tubes, right?
My grand brother, who also came and found the air or something, went into me. He had to go to the bathroom.
Where were we living this?
Total spontaneity.
Where were we living this moment that we had?
And he said, it's just pushing out the cold air.
And yeah.
It really is hot, right?
Just like a car heater, it takes a little while.
Yeah. But so what about that, Kokyo? I mean...
You think that's outside your mind? Mm-hmm.
I mean, how is that outside my mind, other than my perturbations and my pissiness about this stupid cold air?
Well, that's what we're saying, right? That in this Yogacara thing, all eight consciousnesses that, and their objects are mind, right? So that's a sensory experience. Before you even conceptualize it as cold or hot, even the sensation, it's a bodily sensation of temperature, right? Temperature is part of the fifth sense object. But that just like colors, we've talked about, mostly talked about colors, right? Like the black is, there's not really a color out there, it's electromagnetic radiation, right? Same with all five senses. So touch is a big one for us because, you know, with bodies, especially in Sesshin, the fifth consciousness and object is the body, which has, you know, pain and pleasurable sensations, one of which is temperature. And so we're saying, you know, it looks like the mind-only school is saying that that sensation of temperature is, and, you know, again, I like to say with these direct sensory experiences, I think most scientists would also agree that, like, any way that even in the most direct experience that you're experiencing the temperature of cold or hot is not the actual, you know, temperature. How would science describe this, right? It's like it's nerve endings. Nerve endings are, met by a molecule with a certain temperature, I suppose, right? Moving at a certain speed. Okay, yeah. So temperature is actually determined by speed of movement, huh? Cool. So that's so it's like a certain movement of molecules, which we have no, you know. If you take it like that and just look at movement of molecules that have these different effects, we're like, well, I don't care how fast the molecules are moving. But then when it has this bodily effect, it's like even the direct sensation pretty quickly becomes either like positive or negative. But I also noticed it was cool, and
56 degrees.
It's been colder, but but if you're sick, if you're feeling sick, it's especially hard. You're right under a vent thing. We know Dungshan's story about this, right?
So what about freezing when you're cold, burning when you're hot?
Yeah. How can you escape these...
I hate that story.
Hot and cold. Yes.
Right.
That's the third type of word. Yes.
My disturbance of the morning was actually had the word disturbance in it a lot because I was in a verbal back and forth a whole lot about disturbance gradient and protecting the farm fields from people walking on and taking samples, and that's a disturbance you can't call it. So it was very disturbing. Mm-hmm.
Disturbed by the word, disturb.
And then the classic, well, this isn't Zen. I'm not arrived. I'm in the story.
You're back in the field.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you could
it
say...
It felt outside of where I wanted to be.
Yeah, that almost like the fourth type of word, right? That's completely just out of alaya, because we're not out on the field. It's like, so it's a past event. A lot of our thinking is like this past event, and then it's all mixed in with the third type of word of how the self was in the past event, self in relation to others. Usually, I mean, you might just be envisioning like a mountain range, a beautiful mountain range at sunset, and there's no sense of like me in it, but that's still an eighth consciousness thing. I know it's superposed. It's slightly disturbing. A beautiful mountain sunset that we're imagining is slightly disturbing if we're kind of like thinking it was a thing that happened outside our mind. But this one, yeah, of course. So Sachin is great because we get to see how the mind is just doing this stuff all the time. And we can catch ourselves doing that. And it's like, the nice thing is, and if there is a kind of like external world here, if there really is like a kind of like a Sachin going on outside our minds, the nice thing about it is, it doesn't matter much what happens, actually, in that world. You know, it's like the stakes aren't so high. It's because there's like, it's not like the crops won't get watered or something, right? In the realm of the Sachin, if that's all you're doing for this time, and you've kind of like, and you didn't forget to turn off the stove at home or whatever, you know, everything's taken care of. It's like, what we're doing here is kind of like, we're just doing it for Sashin's sake. So it's kind of like, if the food gets burnt or something, it's okay, you know, even if we don't get to eat that meal, there'll be another one. Or, you know, and maybe we could say, if the temperature's too cold or too hot, it's like, it won't kill us. And it's not really that harmful to other beings in a big way, like the fields not getting watered might be. So that's a nice thing about it. I think that's why we create like this really supposedly very simple container, and just say like, then we get to see how much we think things matter, which I can get really caught up in that. Really the serving should go like this, or the bell should go like that. And then if I really like, then do I think that the bell is outside my mind, or the mist bell is outside my mind? But then if I let it go, I guess this is maybe the point that then we really can let it go and it'll be okay. I think that's what part of the purpose of Sachin. It's designed so if we really let go of just like everything, things will be okay. We could create this kind of like safe and supportive container that you can just drop off everything, and it won't have like majorly harmful repercussions, probably. Does that make sense? I want to encourage that for everybody, because like, here's a chance. It's hard to do that in daily life, even just the most mundane things in daily life, like, you know, going to do the laundry or something. It's like, if you just really just like let go of everything, you might be in the laundromat and be like, well, your clothes don't matter, and just, you might just like wander away, and then like, oh, but my clothes are gone. I lost them. I have to buy all new clothes now. It's kind of a major thing. But here it's like, if you forget who you are and what's happening, it's actually okay. Yes. Offended,
so
yes.
You get this story mm-hmm. that unfolds, and at first you're really angry about it, and then you pick it apart, you get information, and then you confront the person. And then they admit it, mm-hmm. like no denial. And then you have to take that and like, okay, well, how do I deal with this now? You know,
yeah.
Fire this person? They just admitted to what back paddle out.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so here's my practice, like, okay, I can totally like lose it in the fire and get out of here. Or I can just concede the point against it. And then I start going back into my adolescence and what I did.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I'm like,
I think the great thing in those situations, I mean, it seems like the ideal, I would say, is like that we forgive everyone for they know not what they do as sentient beings. And and then we can fire them. Like, in other words, like, if it's appropriate, if it's just like, well, this just, you know, it just not doesn't work for this business here, it's okay sometimes to actually say, like, look, it's the 10th time this has happened. I totally forgive you. And you admit it, and I'm like, and I have no, I have no more hostility towards you. This would be the ideal, right? And it just doesn't seem to work for you to work here anymore. You know? So, see, like, the combination. And then you could, like, it's no longer, you know, we could not even have to resent them or feel hostility and not have to keep dealing with the same problem. But fire them not in a way like, get out of here, I don't want to see you again, but just like, you know, thank you for admitting your humanness, for confessing and repenting. You're in accord with the Buddha way, and now, could you find another job? And, you know, maybe I could even help you suggest some companies, but...
Well, the whole thing with the medical marijuana, too, you know, is it's so productive. You know, it's just, it's like everybody does it. And for me, it's like, you know, no, I want a clear, sound mind. And so is this me? Am I projecting my sobriety onto somebody who feels like they can do a better reading if they're, like, zoned out?
So now we're getting into the details of the story. Well, when it gets into, like, you know, the nitty-gritty details, it's like, it's often not so straight, clear-cut or straightforward. It's like a negotiation with words that you have to, you know, do. It's like, and maybe it's about all these conventional agreements and stuff. It's kind of like, maybe you give them a second chance. You get really clear and, like, do you really understand, like, it doesn't work for me, even though you think it works for you. It doesn't work for me, and you're working for me. So, just in the conventional world where we have those kinds of imaginations, can you play this game with me? Because part of the game is I'm hiring you to fulfill certain requirements, and then you can say, if they say like, yeah, I'll play the game, and then then they do it again. You say, oh, but we had an agreement that I gave you a second chance, and you didn't. And maybe they, you know, either they say, oh, will you give me a third one? Or they say, oh, you're right, you know. We had this clear agreement. So I think a lot of these things are about having really clear agreements, which is hard to make really clear agreements. And then sometimes the clear agreements, then we still are somewhat flexible. We say, I really want to give them another chance. So we give them a third chance. And then the fourth time we're like, we remind them that we gave them three chances already. And if they argue, we can just say, what are you doing? Why are you arguing? Isn't it clear? I mean, these are just possible ways these things can come play out. But clear agreements, that for me is one that I've been thinking about a lot as we... maybe it's okay to talk about this potential. We're having these discussions about possible residential practice at Zen Center here. And I'm thinking, and I think the others in the discussion are also agreeing, that if we had this kind of thing, if we implemented it at some point as a kind of official thing, that it's got to be about, like, really clear agreements. If we just kind of like, why don't you just come practice here, you know? We trust your intention. I think it's like, that's kind of nice, but without a really clear agreement, I think big problems can arise. So the clearer things are, then when things don't go with the agreement, then it's easy to say, but we had this clear agreement.
So,
Yeah, yeah. Maybe that's the thing, is like, when you're hiring people, say like, here, even like, written in written words, second type of written words, written dream words, knowing that they're dream words, still they come in handy. And then there's the trick of like, all that's conventional, it's all conventional stuff, making these agreements. So remembering, that's what I really like, that the conceptual words are called dream words, according to the Buddha, like, that we remember that however accurately our conceptions are being made and our agreements are being made, that it's ultimately, in the end, it's just dream words. All these dream words. Now we can take a break from the verbal expression of them and just settle back into our own dream words and disturbance from them. Just testing. May our intention equally extend to every being in place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.